It's Jazz Theater, KEXP Seattle. John Gilbreth here in the studio. Happened to be in the studio here with Nils Klein and Julian Lage in town to play a show at the Royal Room and kind enough to stop by the KEXP studios. Good day, gentlemen.
Hello.
Good day.
Thanks for having us.
Great to see you both here in Seattle. You've both come around some under different circumstances, but this is a fascinating new release out, highly intimate two-guitar setting, live, essentially, called Room, and playing at the Royal Room, appropriately. So I wonder if we can get started with some music and then get back and talk a little bit about the music.
Why not?
Sure.
We're going to play Racy with a little bit of something or other to bring it in.
Nils Klein and Julian Lage, KEXP. Thank you. Nice. Nils Klein and Julian Lage. Racy, right?
Racy, yeah.
A couple of guitar gods for sure. I see on the listing it's got you both as known addresses of New York City, but you're both a couple of California guys, right?
That's true. I grew up in the Bay Area,
yeah.
Santa Rosa, California.
And Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm fascinated with this project and eager to talk about it. In my mind and in some minds, perhaps, both of you seem to be coming at it from kind of different directions. Nils, you know, obviously known for a broad scope of work ranging from Wilco, which you've been a key component of for some years, and some really marvelously adventurous work with Cryptogramophone and various projects like the Nils Klein Singers, No Singers, out of California. And Julian, really, like, in my mind, you can do anything you want to do and frequently do, right?
I appreciate that.
So do you guys consider yourself like a generation apart?
No.
This is the old guy saying that, right? Oh, no.
No, I don't at all either.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm just trying to keep up. So there is the old man trying to keep up factor that
right.
sometimes kicks into my mind when my hand's falling apart. But when we met and started playing, it was not about anything but music. It was uh-huh. not about age or anything like
and
that.
And how did that happen? And was that in New York?
Yes, it was.
It was through Jim Hall, actually.
Oh,
it was and our friend, dear friend Brian Camilio, who was organizing these monthly luncheons that we kind of get Jim out of the house and get all his buddies together.
Right.
And I had been hearing about Nels being at all the ones I missed, and I think vice versa. When I was out of town, they'd say, oh, you got to meet Julian sometime.
Yeah.
And then in due time, we finally met and hit it off. And within a day or so of knowing each other, we started playing music together.
Yeah.
And but that was definitely the meeting ground.
And was the common ground Jim Hall then from the beginning?
Well, actually, yes and no. I mean, I kept hearing about Julian mostly from Jim's lips. And mm-hmm. the reason I was there was because I had written a piece for Jazz Times, 10 tracks by Jim Hall that Brian Camilio had seen and told Jim about.
Cool. All right.
So through a rather labyrinthian path, I came to know Brian, who invited me to what he called the crony lunches, and that he said Jim should meet me and wanted to meet me. Mm-hmm. So when I started going to these things, I kept hearing about Julian from Jim mostly. He kept saying, Julian this, Julian that. So I thought, who's this Julian guy? I had no idea, being basically out of it. And so I went back. Oh, these would happen literally at the end of the street that I live on in the West Village. And Jim lived a block away.
Ah.
That was the other factor here. So I went home and YouTubed Julian.
Kind of remarkable.
And then my jaw dropped and I freaked out. So then I understood also why everyone had such like fond feelings and reverence for this man. And when he finally made it to one of these lunches, we ended up standing outside talking blah, blah, blah about so many different things. And I said, well, why don't you come down the street to the house and check out this guitar that I have that you might like. I don't know why that guitar, but anyway.
I'm glad.
And so he knelt down in the kitchen and played a few things, and it was really beautiful. So we just started playing completely improvised, casually, and I was thinking of starting a project that was going to be a drumless sort of chamber jazz project. And after almost adding instruments, we did a gig as a duo, and that was the end of that. I never looked back, really.
Right,
the only reason I was thinking of not doing a duo is because I'd done so many projects with guitarists as duo, and I thought, gee, am I really going to do another guitar duo? Even though there was nothing unsatisfying about the music, it was just a concept in my mind that I had to change my strategy or something.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So going into this next tune, which is a piece that Nels, you wrote earlier for Jim Hall.
That's true.
For our listeners, perhaps not coming from the jazz highway, can you tell like a couple of sentences about why Jim Hall is really special?
Well, I can, and then Julian can.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I mean, I became a fan of Jim's in the 70s. I think the first record I heard was Jim Hall Live on the A&M Horizon label. And I was working in a record store then, and it was easy to obtain because there were so many promotional copies being sold back then.
I was going to ask if either of you had had day jobs and what they were like.
Well, I worked in
I
worked in a record store from the late 70s to mid 80s, almost 10 years in a record store, and then 8 years in a bookstore. Mm. Handle a lot of filthy lucre in my day. These like cool jobs with no computers and no punch in, punch out time.
It's funny that word lucrative comes out of that.
Yeah, isn't it?
That's wild.
It seems to be a stretch.
And I'm always trying to revive forgotten and somewhat out-of-date words. But anyway, I heard this record, and it was kind of like when I first heard Bill Evans, and I knew it was genius work, but it was a little too subtle and advanced for me. You know, so I just became more and more absorbed with his recordings and just trying to figure out, like, what is with this man besides the amazing musicality and the harmonic and rhythmic factor. When I heard The Bridge, for example, which he's legendary for, with Sonny Rollins, to hear him just play, to comp and play rhythm guitar behind Sonny Rollins is so incredibly inspiring and so rhythmically it propels the band, but it's not forceful. I haven't said just a couple of words about it, but I mean, it's a combination of tone, amazing harmonic ideas, an incredible kind of musicality that's not exciting on the surface, but is deep and thus even more exciting over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
repeated listening reveals more and more beauty and more vision.
Yeah.
And then the fact that he wasn't stuck in a style or in time is very advanced and very forward-looking. So you listen to his later records and you hear amazing harmonic and very modern and forward-looking ideas musically, just in terms of arranging and composing, not just guitar playing.
Mm-hmm.
So all that meant to me that he was the guy.
Yeah. And all of that...
I second that.
All of that strikes me, too. And then on the surface, very, very, very accessible. I mean, a lot of people just getting into it wouldn't know that there's that much stuff going on underneath.
Well, rather like Bill Evans, I think, or many other great musicians for whom musicians find incredible depth and nuance, and other people say, like, that's really nice.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly, right.
But Julian, say a few words about Jim.
Oh, my God. Well, I second everything Nels said. I mean, to me, Jim was the kind of father of modern jazz guitar, and what comes with that is not only the things that Nels talked about, the depth of musicality, the nuance, the compositional abilities, all that, but just such a high degree of humor and kind of wit in a genre of music, especially with the guitar, that can be so deadly serious. Jim took a lot of risks, and he tried things that were really intelligent and really hilarious and really really had the power to provoke other musicians and to bring other people, I think, just lift them higher than they had ever been. And that was noticeable if you played with Jim or if you even listened to his records or if you saw him talking in an interview, anything. Mm-hmm. You got the sense that this guy really wanted everyone to succeed with him, and just someone very dear to me as a friend whom I love. So, yeah, Jim's the guy.
Let's hear this tune. It's KEXP Seattle Jazz Theater. Yeah, Nels.
It's worth mentioning that when I met Julian, it was just days later that he was playing down the street at the Blue Note in Jim's band.
That's right.
So, and I hadn't heard Jim play live for a little while at that point, so that was sort of the first time I saw Julian play live was with Jim.
Yeah.
I mean, they'd been playing on and off for quite a while at that point. So that's pretty amazing.
That's right, a setting there in which you want to be on your toes, right?
My God, yeah. It's so humbling.
It's with Joey Barron and Scott Cawley. Yeah. Pretty good band.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. All right, let's hear this piece. It's blues, too, and it's based off a piece that Jim Hall wrote earlier.
Not really.
Kind it's just in the style of some of his earlier writing.
Yeah, I was thinking about him. It's a little bit like...
I'm thinking of the stuff on Subsequently.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, right? Exactly.
It's like a vernacular that he kind of toyed with a lot.
So I wrote this in 1991. Now here we go.
It's Nels Klein and Julian Lage live here at KEXP, where the music matters. Blues too. Thank you. Absolutely phenomenal. Nels Klein and Julian Lage on Nels' composition, Blues 2. Man.
I think I'm up to three chords of a chop now.
You got them all.
Can you say a little bit about the song form that you guys are working with? I mean, I don't know if I know the term, but
yeah.
Were you working off of compositions and a lot of improvisations? And it strikes me as watching you that there's even flexibility on the compositional, on the through composed part.
Plenty of latitude. But that particular piece has a little bit of a strategic...
A form, right?
Kind of a form.
The idea of it, and I think it works best, nothing against the various people who've played this song with me, because it's one of the few songs I've written that I've done with, you know, I can just bring it and say, hey, let's jam on this. But the directive of it usually gets ignored, which is to play the head, allude to blues in E-flat.
And what is the simple head?
It's just this. It's kind of a blues, but not really. And then this blues in E-flat, and it happens at one point after the head. Whatever, and then we're supposed to leave, depart.
And when you say at one point after the head, do you mean like 12 bars, 24 bars, or just at any point after the head?
When I first learned it, it was like half of a blues in E-flat was the directive, I remember. Okay. Get through
and then half. And then we just spontaneously compose and try not to get too excited. Not too dense, you know, not too busy, which can happen later, but I really want to do some spontaneous and rather thoughtful improvising.
Yeah.
Nothing against quick, rapid fire improvising that's not thoughtless,
no,
but you know what? I'm just something more highly considered,
say.
I guess,
yeah.
And not exciting. Mm-hmm. And then what ended up happening after a while was I started adding the tribute to Jim Hall drone middle Latin section, which in this case is like an A7 chord, basically. And I like to play because it's there not only because he did it a lot and I love it, but also because it was very, it's still very unusual for a so-called jazz great to use so many idiomatic sounds of the guitar. And the idiomatic sounds can include, besides harmonics and whatnot, open strings. So he had plenty of times when he would just love to turn down, like way down, and just like... Thank you. And so so we do that for a little while. Sometimes it's in 6/8, sometimes it's in 4/4. I mean, it's sometimes it's faster than other times, you know. And then we depart from that at will and eventually go back into the theme without any cue, really.
Mm-hmm. And as far as who's playing lead and who's playing rhythm at any given time, that's...
It's so fluid. It's kind of whatever... It's hard for us to determine what's happening, probably.
I'd love to stay and talk for another couple of hours about this stuff. Let's hear some more music. There's a piece called Calder, and I can imagine some inspiration. This is yours.
Yeah, this is a piece I wrote.
We're going to hear some bright colors in this piece, right?
You might. It's on the darker side.
Oops.
bright can be dark, too. It's like it's kind of this. There's a bittersweet quality to this, and I wrote it for Nels with him in mind, and named it after a. Replica of a Calder mobile that I have hanging in my apartment that was a gift from my mom. So,
nice.
Anyway, here's Calder.
Do it. KEXP, Seattle Jazz Theater. Thank you. Wow. That is just gorgeous. Nels Klein, Julian Lage, Julian's composition, Calder. That very last chord there, did you invent that chord for two guitars, or did it evolve as a bigger chord you've added one?
I think it evolved as a bigger chord and was kind of... I knew it would be that tonality, but Nels came in and added this kind of...
Is there a name for what it turns out to be, that particular chord?
If there is,
chord?
I don't want to know it. No. See,
I think it's a little intentionally vague.
It's pretty vague.
But it's just gorgeous, and it's so strong. I mean, it just, as a departing note, it's just like...
Thank you. I like that chord.
I think that was... Well, we tend to arrange all of our stuff together, and sort of some parts are rather... strictly composed, as all the harmony that Julian's playing with that melody that he wrote is as is for the most part. But then if we get into an area where we're not sure how to end it, or other times I say, hey, Julian, I have this idea and it's kind of something like this. And then I start to play a line and he starts, oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, we basically have arranged something that I didn't even know is finished. And then... that's part of the joy of what we're doing is not only sometimes finishing each other's musical sentences, but also each other's pieces.
Yes, quite literally.
By the time you had played that chord twice, even before I could articulate the thought, I was thinking, are they going to play that same chord the third time?
That's great. I love things like that set up an expectation, because you can either fulfill it, and that's one way, and you can also deny it, and that's another feeling.
I have another couple of questions before we play the last one, connected with the word jazz, which has gotten to be such a big word and such a kind of a dangerous word in some circles, but assuming kind of an off-the-shelf definition of what jazz may be. Julian, you're in your mid-20s. Mm. Do you think there's some kind of a genetic code that brings people to move to jazz? I mean, we see it here in high school jazz programs, but there's kind of this... construct where people would move toward it, but I assume you it was more of a biological or.
Well, you know, I don't know is the real answer. I was really drawn to it as a little kid because my parents played jazz in the house, but a lot of what I loved about it was that I didn't know anyone who did it. You know, it's kind of I liked jazz and I liked ham radio and I liked anything that was seemingly just on the periphery that it was mine, you know?
And when did you pick up guitar?
Picked up guitar when I was 5. And I was into blues, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Muddy Waters, Stephen Walker. Oh yeah, and I still love that. And it was at some point someone said, you should check out Jim Hall or Wes Montgomery. I was probably around 8 or so.
Yeah.
And so I do think there's a certain disposition towards improvised music that a lot of jazz musicians I know share. There's a certain just kind of curiosity about it that I suppose if you weren't curious, it might be more forced. But I just think, you know, I started as a little kind of a niche thing for me, but I think jazz is so accessible. And the way I look at it is it's a very human expression. And for that, I'm grateful. And that's just my take on it.
We're all grateful to have you in it.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, and a long road in front of you, we all hope.
God willing.
Yeah. Yeah, inshallah, huh?
Yeah.
And Nils, the aspect that I want to talk about with you is I was just in New York for conferences and jazz fests like I like to do every year. And last year I saw you in the NYU law building doing a duo with Jim Black that was about as skronky as the NYU law building has ever seen, I'm sure. But I heard some musicians saying that, you know, in doing work as a jazz musician in the rock arena, that sometimes there's a certain kind of deference that other musicians will turn on a jazz musician, partly because they, I guess, assume that they'll have more chops or that they'll know like 2,000 songs in every key or something like that. And so I wonder, number one, is there kind of, in your work with Wilco and in that world, is there a bump or is some little kind of a fence, if not a wall, between you and the other players, or is it an automatic and seamless thing? And then I'm curious, too, about and those aspects of jazz music that are not immediately, that the melody is, that you have to kind of sneak up on it or really spend some time with it to find the handle on it when it's the melody or the hook is not immediate on that stuff. How do you bring people to it, or how do you talk to them about it and say, you know, don't let this scare you away just because you can't tap your toe to it immediately?
Mm. Well, I'll address your second question before the Wilco one. I guess where concerns music of, I guess, more abstract or subtle or possibly extreme qualities, I figure that I was drawn to it, so other people probably will be eventually, and if they're not, I can't really worry about it, frankly. But I think it's worth noting that a lot of what I feel Julie and I are doing here is very closely related to innovations in so-called jazz music that were happening in the 1950s. So it's not exactly new. Mm-hmm. Certainly by the 60s, there was even a term called free jazz, which means basically nothing, except that there, in many cases, were not chord changes and maybe in certain cases, no actual strict time.
Yeah, there's a great Ornette Coleman quote where he says, don't give me any rhythm, don't give me any changes, don't give me any melody.
He didn't like transposition. He wanted everyone to play in the key of his or her instrument. And I think it's worth noting, perhaps we could become depressed by it, but it's just worth noting that I think in Los Angeles, where I come from now, if you were to walk into a so-called jazz club and say, we're going to play an all Ornette Coleman program, they would probably say, no, that's too out for us. And he was playing that exact music in Los Angeles in 1958 at the mm-hmm. Hillcrest Club. Yeah. So I don't know how far we've come, but certainly...
Well, you recognize that L.A. is a little bit of an enigma as far as jazz getting traction in a city that's really large and essentially a music town, but
totally. It's
you know, it's like you're that right. finger popping stuff where it's not happening.
Yeah, I think that's true in almost every American city at this point. And some cities are a little hipper than others, but most of them are pretty challenged in the improvised music appreciation department. I was inspired to listening to not straight ahead jazz at first. So I came to listening to more traditional jazz from the other side. I was listening to so-called free jazz. I was listening to so-called jazz rock, which became known as fusion. I was listening to Weather Report and Herbie Hancock and John McLaughlin and Miles. And my main guy was Coltrane. And the music I was drawn to was so-called anti-jazz, I learned later, which was his modal quartet period. And then some of the later, much more, I guess you would say, avant-garde recordings and projects. So that's where I came in. So it kind of goes to the Mike Watt saying, the only thing new is you finding out about it. And sometimes you finding out about something is something that's actually existed 45 years ago, you know, and that's, it was just time. It was just time for you. So I don't worry too much about trying to bring people to it, but I do make music to connect with people emotionally because I'm an emotional type player, I think. I don't really work the high concept too much. I think that we want the music to feel like something. And if people say like, wow, that actually sounded pleasant, even though it sounded completely chaotic,
it's the best.
That's fine. That's, you know, but if we play a concert, we're not going to just do that. You know, we're interested in presenting music that makes you feel something, not just that shows off what we know how to do or the thought we might have thought of and made up in this on the spot. I don't know. It's that we have other pieces like Calder that are, I think, emotionally engaging, not just interesting musically. And then as far as the so-called rock band and me, I say this without rancor in terms of my history of playing in rock bands as well as playing with so-called jazz people. And I would use the word jazz cautiously because I don't consider myself to be a real jazz player. I consider myself to be a bit of a tourist where jazz is concerned. And I certainly don't know 2,000 songs in every key. But I love and appreciate all kinds of so-called jazz. And I've found that many of the rock so-called players are far more curious about my jazz and improvising life than the jazz players are interested in my rock life. So, but that said, many of the people I play with now have, and I think Julian, Bill Frisell, Jenny Scheinman, people I've played with on and off and still do play with, have a deep appreciation and curiosity and love for songs.
Yeah.
Songwriting, as we hear in the folk tradition, and I think that that's something that really crosses over into Wilco world, and something that I was much less sensitive to when I joined Wilco. I was just wanted to see how this Wilco thing would work out.
Yeah. Seems to have worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it's been almost 11 years now, and it's a joy, frankly. We're still having a blast, and I think I'm really proud of the shows that we do and the records we make. And without it, this sounding weird, my love and my estimation of Jeff Tweedy's songwriting skills have only increased over time.
Me too. Especially, and in addition, through the Mavis Staples songs.
Oh, man.
And his writing he's for incredible. Mavis, incredible. Yeah,
yeah, he's done some great stuff. And now they're about to release an unreleased Pop Staples record that I just cannot wait for you to hear was in the can, that was a disaster in terms of production. It had all these hideous horn arrangements and wheezing synthesizers and all this stuff, and Pop's guitar mixed out of the record, and Mavis brought it to Jeff, and they basically
extracted,
took
some parts,
all that stuff off.
Nice.
And it's what I've heard of it is utterly profound and a real gift to the world. But we digress.
We do. We should move on. It's KEXP Seattle. We're talking to Nels Klein, Julian Lage, and having a ball doing it, listening to music. And man, it has really been a pleasure to have you guys in here. And as I say, I'd love to talk a bit longer, but I know you've got things on your schedule. You've probably got your retinue outside and the limousine idling.
Oh, wait. Well, you got to see our tour vehicle.
Oh, my God.
It's barely big enough for these tiny amps and these guitars and
let
two suitcases. Oops.
Touring by
well,
Prius.
Thank you, John, so much.
Yeah,
it's really
wonderful.
Lovely to be here, and also because you're such a sensitive and astute listener, it really makes it a lot of fun.
Way great.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So the piece that you're going to end with is a piece that's got odd end. It's called Odd End, but it actually has an odd end. And because I've already heard that odd end once before, can you tell me what's going on in that odd end as far as the harmony of it?
It just seems a half step, wanky. This is a piece that this is one of those pieces that I was describing where I had this idea, and the next thing we knew, basically, we had arranged it together and finished it. But I could never justify this bridge that I had written. And Julian was like, no, the bridge is good, and, well, the chords, and whatever. And I said, well, you should just solo. And so it's one of the few things where we have designated solo spots. So it's kind of a fusion kind of piece, I guess, to use the F word. but I think I just didn't know how to end it. And Julian thought it would be a really great idea to just play the line a half step away from me. Mm. And so that's what happens at the end. So it's a combination. The title is a combination of a reference to this ending, but also the fact that it's all in seven.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Can you just rip off that ending?
Oh, there might have some stuff that's not in seven.
I can't remember.
But it has some short bars.
It has some short bars.
Yeah, that was the other thing we do when we sometimes arrange together is chop a couple of beats off.
Yeah.
Can you just rip that ending just so people know what we're talking about?
One, two, three, four.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
That's it.
All right, so here it comes.
Odd End, Nels Klein, Julian Lage.
Thank you.
KEXP Seattle. Thank you so much. Thank you. KEXP Seattle.